This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More about me at rajbalkaran.com. More importantly, today I get to speak with Dr. Srilata Raman. She is a professor of Hinduism at the Department for the Study of Religion at the University of Toronto. We'll be speaking about a brand new Routledge publication, a fascinating work called The Transformation of Tamil Religion. Srilata, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Raj. Very happy to be here.
Yes, and happy to have you here. It's very rare that I have a podcast guest that's in the same city as I am. Congratulations, you're now full professor at the University of Toronto. That's excellent.
Yes. I'm really happy about it as well.
Yes, well, it's quite an achievement at the Academy. And so this book of yours, now, tell us a bit about the backstory. Clearly, these research interests have been around for a while for you, but is there a particular impetus behind this project?
Yes, there is. Well, I had, my training in Germany. And in Germany, it's... Once you've done your doctorate, you have to do a second degree to qualify for professorial jobs. It's called a habilitation. And usually what they require of you for a habilitation is an entirely different topic and area of expertise than what you did for your doctorate, because the idea is to be able to show that you can do a breadth of work to qualify for a professorial position. So it was very clear to me that my first book, which was on Vaishnavism, I couldn't just do more work on Vaishnavism for a habilitation, as it's called in English, but I had to think about something completely different. And then I was mentioning this to the person whom actually I've dedicated the book to, V. Geeta, who's a great scholar and intellectual of Tamil religion, and who also just happens to be a friend of mine, and well, not of Tamil religion, of Tamil literature and Tamil nationalism, basically. And I said to her, I really need to, be doing something completely different, not Vaishnava, not, the whole Sanskritic Brahminical milieu. And she said, well, there is this very interesting figure called Ramalinga Swamigal. And I don't know, you might find him interesting because he was also such an important poet, right? And then that's how it started. I just discovered that, and this happens, I think, to people quite a lot, that I had learned as a child several songs which are very beautiful, very simple songs, without knowing they had been composed by him. I mean, one doesn't know the composer necessarily when one learns songs as a child. And then I thought, oh, heavens, I mean, that's very interesting. And that's how it started. It started with wanting to look at something completely different. And then it ended up being this something that I actually I've labored over for, you know, more than a decade. And this has been the result.
Fascinating read. Certainly you put this figure on the map, at least, you know, for me. I mean, there may be others who might be more aware of this saint. Tell us a bit for our more generalist audience, who is this figure?
Okay, so Ramalinga Swamigal is this figure from a less prestigious caste in the Tamil country, who, you know, he, as I point out in the book, he's like many other figures who emerged in the 19th century from more subaltern backgrounds, who were, due to the colonial moment, became interested in starting a new religious movement of some kind, you know, were interested in certain kind of reformist ideals, inspired by the pan-Indian, you know, socio-religious reform, including particularly the Brahma Samaj, which had a huge impact nationwide in the 19th century, which has not been explored that much, actually, in the sources this far. So he starts off as that. And then he is actually, and I say that in the book, it's actually a failure. He wrote a prolific corpus of poetry and then some prose works, but it never really took off. And interestingly, when I spoke to one of his eminent hagiographers, Uranadigal, as to why it didn't take off, Uranadigal told me this fascinating, said to me, well, you see, he said, Ramalinga wanted, was propagating vegetarianism in a huge way, you know, and non-killing of animals and so on, to a people of his caste background and others who were traditionally always had a non-vegetarian diet, have been meat eaters. So this was not going down well, said Uranadigal. You can't build a phenomenal movement expecting people to change their dietary habits, just whatever. I found this a fascinating take. Regardless, it did not take off. It only takes off a good almost half a century after his fascinating disappearance, which I write about in the book, thanks to the Tamil political movement. He's adopted by, his movement is supported by Omandurar, who becomes very briefly the chief minister of Tamil Nadu. But then he gets picked up by this family of sugar baron family, Pollachi Mahalingam, who's a very fascinating figure himself. And that family basically single-handedly helps to transform, make him well known. He gets picked up by the Dravidian nationalist movement and the self-respect movement because of his more radical writing in the latter years of his life. And then he becomes pretty much the secular, within quotes, Dravidian saint. And in fact, the current Tamil Nadu government has actually declared his birthday a day of, it's called the Day of Special Benevolence, Thani Perum Karunai Day, to celebrate. So it's sort of really the apotheosis, very nicely, just when my book is coming out. So this is this figure. I also point out that figures like Ramalinga sink into obscurity, and there are lots of them in the 19th century. Perhaps not every single one who wrote as much and as beautifully and some amazing poetry like he did. But there are several figures, but they don't make it into the sort of situation where you become famous in some way. And I point out that usually a local saint is a dialect with an army, right? Or a dialect with an army becomes a language. So a saint becomes famous if he has a very good hagiographer or hagiographers, and if he or she has a nice little corpus, and in the 19th century onwards, a really good editor, somebody who is sort of bringing out the works and commenting on it, editor, commentator. And Ramalinga was very fortunate in that in his foremost disciple, Thoruvur Velayudamudra, he had a brilliant sort of editor and commentator of his works. And that, of course, helped to raise him to the status which he enjoys today, not just in Tamil Nadu, by the way, but in Malaysia, in Singapore, wherever there's the Tamil diaspora, but particularly Malaysia, and he's very famous.
I find this particular line of thought, this lens, so intriguing. How do you make it as a saint? How do you make it? It's sort of like an American Idol in an alternate universe situation, yeah, where many people audition, but who made it and why? And of course, you touched on some key elements, at least in this case. I'm wondering if in your view, do you see other analogs in Hinduism, other figures who you might see as having a similar rise, whether they're well known or not?
Yes, well, I think if one could possibly say that of any of the key figures of colonial modernity, whether it's Ram Mohan Roy, whether it's Keshab Chandra Sen, all of these people. I think the difference is you don't see that first, you don't, in Ramlinga's case, you have a lapse into obscurity between 1874 when he disappears and the 1930s. And then he's resurrected, right? And I mean, I think a parallel is what perhaps it's not too far-fetched to say that sort of parallel which you have with, Sardar Patel now in India. I mean, it's not that Vallabhai Patel was ever obscure. That's obvious. I mean, that's not what I'm saying. But suddenly having a monumental statue put up by the Narendra Modi government and evoking him so consistently that, and then a new biography comes out about him, I think came out about 5 years ago. So there is a renewed interest, and then there's a major revival of the figure's popularity, right? And in Ramlinga's case, the difference between his being relatively obscure to now, I mean, I think there was a rupture, a very definite rupture. But you see that, I think, with other figures who get adopted and adapted to certain national or regional nationalistic purposes.
Fascinating. So for your monograph, what sources or types of sources or data are you looking at?
Okay, so I began by looking at the hagiographies and then the later biographies. But I was, the book is actually in two parts because it's actually both the man and his work. And I think what Ramalinga is very famous for is a certain doctrine called Jiva Karunyam, which is compassion towards all living beings. And there is this very extraordinary work he wrote called The Conduct of Compassion towards Living Beings, Jiva Karunya Urukam, which I've analyzed. So I began with the hagiographies and biographies, but of course they are insistent that the reason why he's so important is because of this doctrine. And then I was, reading literally every word he was writing. And I mean, this is a huge corpus. So that took up a good chunk of my life, just reading everything about him. And what became evident to me, and I think this is, this is not an exaggeration to say that every single work that has been written on Ramalinga right up to today, and as recent as 2019, when a monograph about him came out, have not explored in any in any depth where this doctrine comes from. There is an assumption that he almost sort of invented it, or of course he was inspired by the whole ethical turn in colonialism about how Hinduism is not ethical enough or needed to be more ethical or whatever. But it's at that level of generalities. But I felt, I mean, after spending years on this, that, that it was still eluding me, and I wasn't satisfied with thinking about this doctrine as something, you know, that he just conjured out. So then I started to read the works that he himself published, which were some of them, which were made, which he actually retrieved from relative obscurity and published. And by publishing, gave it a wider audience. And then I realized that Ramalingar, and I had this discussion with Brian Hatcher once, that Ramalingar is, you know, there are certain figures from the 19th century, particularly the first half, who cannot be understood without understanding that they are intellectually linked to a pre-modern past very strongly, which goes back several centuries before them, because they are still in an unbroken line of learning, which is changing very rapidly, but they still have learned in that traditional way. So you cannot do justice to these figures without basically going back. And I went back to Tamil Shaivism from the 15th to the 19th centuries and discovered where he was coming from. So the book is actually, you know, it does two things. One is, of course, it's looking at how Ramalingar and his hagiographies and how he's changed Tamil religion in the 19th century and beyond. But the other really important thread, which might be of interest to scholars of pre-modern Hinduism, is the genealogy of certain kinds of works of Tamil Shaivism, which are both the Tamil Shaiva Siddhanta and Tamil Veera Shaivism from the 15th to the 19th centuries.
How might you characterize his primary influence or impact on tradition or legacy, if you will?
You mean the legacy he's left behind?
Correct. You know, how would you characterize the impact he's had?
His impact, as I said, has been, I think his impact keeps changing and growing. He became very important for Dravidian nationalism in the 1920s, which saw in him the possibility of accepting at least some aspect of Tamil Shaivism that seemed more ethical, that seemed more caste critical. And so he becomes favored, but his subsequent impact has been, as I said, right now, a very conscious construction of a non-Hindutva, Dravidian, secular, regional sort of, sort of ethical position, and he's become important for that. But his, I would say his lasting legacy has been, I mean, very, very simple, that and that's how his organizations, which still exist, actually see their, you know, see as their primary motivating factor to exist, which is feed the poor, feed the starving when they need it. And make food available, you know, regardless of caste and creed and so on. So the big thing was when the COVID was happening and there was obviously, you know, rural India, we all know there was tremendous poverty overnight. People couldn't, you know, practice their livelihoods, return to their villages all over India and were suffering from, you know, lack of any livelihood. So there was a corresponding increase in poverty and malnutrition. And one of the things I think the Ramalingar, you know, organizations, particularly the main one in Vadalur, saw as their job was simply to keep open a feeding house to give food to anybody who walked in who was really hungry. And that's, I think, been his very concrete, very lasting legacy. The other thing, for example, there was this fascinating report just from a couple of weeks ago on WhatsApp, which I read about how the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh tried to go and start exercises in a Maidan in Vadalur, the headquarters. And basically the devotees of Ramalinga turned up and told them, you can't do this here. We are, this is Vadalur, it's Vallalar as he's known, it's his place. And he never believed in any discrimination on the basis of religion, or he didn't believe in any religion which separated one from the other. So, I mean, obviously in popular memory, in attitudes, he stands for this even today.
Fascinating. You mentioned in passing that your book is in two parts. Perhaps you can walk us through the structure of the book.
Okay, so the first part is called Retrieving Ramalinga Swamigal. And what I do in that is I have five chapters where first I look, I sort of present, you know, the life story taken from all the hagiographical sources from, sort of if you had to have a template of the life, this is what it would look like, and of his corpus of writings. And then I move on to so that chapter is called Pulavar to Prophet, a 19th century life. And then I move on to looking at the earliest hagiographies, which are all grappling with the fact that one day he says, supposedly says, well, you know, basically my movement has failed. I opened my shop. Nobody wanted to buy my wares. I'm leaving. And he goes into a room, closes the door, and is never seen again. And of course, supposedly, right? And of course, there are fascinating variations already in what he said and how he said it and so on, even in the earliest hagiographies. So I deal with all of that. And I show that for them, he is a sort of quintessential Shaiva saint. He's a Siddha. He obviously, Siddhas vanish into the light. They have these super, they have these Siddhis or Pas, and he's one of them and so on. But they're all also uneasy because they're not 16th century hagiographies, they're 19th century ones. There's an element of unease with all of this anyway. And then I go on to deal with, I move to two chapters on where he's actually coming from with this doctrine of Jiva Karunyam or compassion. And I go back and show that it's deeply anchored in Shaivite literature, starting from the 15th century with works like the Urivilodukam and Tugalarubodham and so on. And it's really about the Shiva yogi who reaches a state of Shiva realization or Shiva anubhuti, which then more or less makes them act as, you know, deeply compassionate persons, right? I mean, it's not very different from the Bhagavad Gita idea that the jnani sees everybody the same, you know, samadrishti and all of that. And that's, but what is interesting and fascinating is that the word Jiva Karunyam is repeatedly used both in the Tamil Shaiva Siddhanta and Tamil Veera Shaiva texts, particularly to refer to one of the qualities of the Shiva yogi and as central to the Shiva yogi. So, and then I move on to show, but in his own time, his image was deeply contested. I have a chapter called the Anti-Hagiography, which shows that Arumuganavalar, this very famous Shaiva reformer from Sri Lanka, got into a dispute with Ramalinga, and this resulted in what I call the Anti-Hagiography, which is the Poliyaruppa Maruppu, a text which attacks Ramalinga in all sorts of personal polemical ways. And I use that to talk about polemics in the colonial period, about what print does to ideas of authorship, about you know, how Ramalinga as a sort of subaltern figure is not conforming to new norms of normativity and therefore is attacked for that. So that's the first part, which is digging, you know, how was he seen in his time? Where do his doctrines really come from? His sort of the intellectual genealogy and the older hagiographies. The second part called Recreating Ramalinga Swamigal, which is four chapters, begins with two chapters which are really dwelling on what is happening to Shaivism as a public way of being and practicing between 1874 and the 1950s. It's about Shaiva associational activity. What are the so-called Shaiva organizations in the Tamil region doing? So the two things I'm doing there, one is I'm complicating the idea that modern Shaivism is emerging only in a rural milieu. I'm showing that it's happening all over, both in rural, urban, semi-urban contexts. Only in the historiography of modern Shaivism, only the urban is emphasized. I go on to show how some of these Shaiva organizations are actually run by women. So I speak about something like civic religion and how women are actually important players in it as well. And then I talk about a figure who's a traditional religious head from a Mata, Nyaniya Radigal, who was very active in the creation of what I would call modern Shaivism, but who has since been, you know, relatively forgotten because he doesn't fit in neatly into a paradigm of an urban a production of modern Shaivism or neo-Shaivism, which is happening in the encounter with Western Orientalists. And then I say all this happens, and then we have the later hagiographers / biographers who were very important political figures in the Tamil region in the 1940s and 50s. One is Thiruvi Kalyana Sundaranar, who's really the more interesting figure, Gandhian, Marxist, Shaivite, and what he does with Ramalinga. And then you have Mapo Sivanyanam, who's a Congress figure, but a Dravidian nationalist, and what he does. And then I end with the chapter, what I call Ramalinga Redux, which is, you know, how his re-emergence in the landscape of the Tamil country. So that's pretty much the book.
Fascinating. If you'll indulge me, just one question for a more generalist audience. Could you say a word or two about Dravidian nationalism?
Yeah, so Dravidian nationalism is what you could call both a cultural and a political movement, and has its emergence in the latter decades, the last couple of decades of the 19th century, through first, you know, the discovery of the Tamil classics, of Sangam literature. So the antiquity of Tamil literature feeds into it. It starts with the discovery, the linguistic discovery of the Dravidian languages, as opposed to the Indo-European, the Aryan. Missionaries play a huge role in it. Robert Caldwell, G.U. Pope. So it's sort of cultural. And then it gains a huge impetus with the emergence of the Justice Party in the colonial period, which decides that the interests of the Tamils or the Southern people is not adequately represented by the Indian National Congress. Particularly, the Congress is seen as a party not just of Gandhians, but of Brahmins. And so what happens to the non-Brahmins? And so the Justice Party morphs into the self-respect Swayamaryade movement, which takes a very strong anti-Brahmin, anti-Sanskrit, anti-Aryan, anti-North India in a certain phase stance, and for a regional pride, a regional nationalism. And so that movement of Dravidian nationalism has a very critical, uneasy relationship with Tamil religion for obvious reasons, because it feels, because a lot of the production of The literature of Tamil was heavily influenced, or there was a mutual interaction with Sanskrit, which led to a huge production of literature in the monasteries or mathas. And the Dravidian movement is about, you know, sort of rupturing the ties between Tamil and Sanskrit. But as I try to show, that is one of the reasons why Ramalinga is understood not in his context in modernity, in Tamil modernity, because to know that he was deeply influenced by works like the Urivilodaka, the Chinmaya Deepika, that he actually, by the Tamil Shaiva Siddhanta, is problematic because the Tamil Shaiva Siddhanta has so much of Sanskrit in it as well, right? So Dravidian nationalism is about rupturing that relationship and speaking for the pure and authentically Tamil. But of course, they still wanted, you know, they saw in Ramalinga the potential for some rapprochement with Shaivism, which was more critical, particularly caste critical, which was more ethical, and so on. But to have the Ramalinga they wanted, they had to ignore a huge part of his intellectual trajectory.
You mentioned in passing that there might be those interested, particularly in this main thread of this intellectual link to a pre-modern past, for example. Who might most benefit from the book? What subfields are implicated or discussed? Could you say a bit about that?
Yeah. Okay. So, in a sort of fairly Indological way, people working on the textual sources of Tamil Shaivism from its emergence particularly the 14th century onwards, I think would find this of great interest, because it's looking at works that people have not looked at yet. So that's the narrowest field. The second is anybody interested in subaltern religion would, I think, find it really interesting, because I show how Ramalinga is not the only one picking up on Jiva Karunya, but the other major intellectual, like, Dr. Ambedkar, but in the Tamil country, Ayodhyadas Panditar, this Dalit, towering Dalit intellectual, is also picking up on Jiva Karunya, and possibly from the very similar sources as Ramalinga. And there are other Dalit figures like Isu Sachidananda Swamigal, who's also picking up on Jiva Karunya. Only none of them have been looked at for Jiva Karunya. So it's also really about how subaltern figures rethinking religion and religious ethics in this period. So I think anybody interested in subaltern religiosity in the colonial period would find that those chapters interesting. And a big thread in the book is about hunger and discourses of hunger in Tamil literature and the issue of the starving body, but the gendering of the starving body as well. So how the starving body is, you know, very often in Ramalinga, the starving body is male. But then I go back to looking at a long textual genealogy of starvation and hunger, which actually is part of another project I'm doing. But so hunger, starvation, and how is it dealt with from as literary representation, that might be of interest to people who work on that as social historians and as people who work on literatures of hunger generally.
Now, turning to this tantalizing thought of this other project you're working on, tell us about what next or what other, what is this other project, if you don't mind sharing?
Yeah, well, there are two things. One is a book which I've called Pasipini, which is just going to be translations of works on literary, you know, novels, from the Sangam and so on, about how hunger is talked about in Tamil literature. So that's, I'm hoping to just have a collection of works the English and the Tamil, and then the English, a kind of bilingual work. But my big project is one I'm now calling, and I'll probably change the name, I just call it Dalit Vedanta, which is really about figures far more obscure than Ramalinga, who were writing these very erudite texts in the 19th century, which are squarely within the realm of a Shiva Advaita, a Shaivite sort of monism, which is, you know, which becomes central to the Tamil Shaiva Siddhanta, Tamil Veera Shaivism by the 19th century. So what are they writing? And I find that the retrieval of it may be important in some ways, I hope, as a contribution towards Dalit historiography in the Tamil region, but then in a pan-Indian way. But it's all, this is all at a very incipient stage. I've just finished the book, so.
Yes, you've just given birth, so you'll have to take a bit of a break.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
But, you know, post-gestation of these other works, perhaps you'll be back on the podcast. You're welcome anytime.
Thank you so much.
I also wanted to share one very important point about the book. For those of let's put it this way. I happen to have two books out by Routledge, and my students can't afford them. Now, I this is just the way of the world in publishing, but I couch the fact that this book is open access.
Yes.
Right, and this is not a small boon. Insofar as in the podcast notes, you'll have a link to this book, and just magically, mystically, by a couple of clicks of your thumbs or four fingers or what have you, you'll have this work available to you, open access. So if you're at all interested, by all means, go and check it out. Srilata, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you, Raj, for giving me this opportunity to talk about something that's obsessed me for a very long time.
My pleasure. This is what we do. We help people deal with their obsessions, their scholarly obsessions on the podcast. That's excellent. So for those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Srilata Raman, who's professor at the department, professor of Hinduism at the Department for the Study of Religion at the University of Toronto. We've been speaking with her about her brand new 2022 Routledge publication, The Transformation of Tamil Religion. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating ancient Indian saints. Take care.